Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Lindsay Smart, and I'm chairing this session on capital markets, alternative funding solution for life insurers, and really glad to be doing this because it's dealing with new ideas and possibilities for the future. So very appreciative of Paul presenting this today. So I think Paul doesn't need much introduction, but I'll just tell you a little bit about Paul Caputo. Based in Sydney, Paul now heads up Towers Watson's Australian Insurance Consulting Practice. And Paul has worked in a range of senior roles in the insurance sector in both Australia and Asia. His career highlights include Executive Director, Chief Risk Officer, Senior Vice President, Capital Markets for Genworth Financial Australia, Executive Director and CFO, Krungthai AXA Life, Thailand, establishing a life company in Thailand, and various management and technical roles at MLC. So as you can see and know, Paul is very well qualified to be presenting to us today, and we look forward to this presentation. So Paul will present, and he's quite interested in feedback. It may be better to try and leave the questions towards the end, but we'll just play it a bit by ear. So let's welcome Paul. Thanks.
Thanks, Lindsay. Look, today I wanted to just give a bit of a background and overview of the capital markets, and in particular the capital markets relevant for insurance securitisation. I'm going to try and give some examples from some transactions, and to be honest, since the GFC, the number of transactions for life companies has, or insurance entities, has decreased, but we're starting to see the markets now open up probably over the last 12 months and on a global perspective. I want to talk about some structuring options and the pros and cons of some of those structuring options, and in particular I'm going to look at things like a VIF securitisation versus a DAC securitisation, and then considerations around whether it's a debt or equity type structure. Some key business considerations and then questions. But look, given it's such a small room, if there is some burning questions, I am happy to take them along the way as well. Okay. Look, insurers and shareholders in a broader context have an extensive toolkit available to them to optimise capital. And what we're showing you here is really a schematic of the various options that an organisation does have. Fundamentally, I'm focusing on the capital options. And what I have done is I've circled capital in both the reinsurance and in the capital solutions. And the reason that is often capital market solutions are interchangeable with reinsurance structures, either directly with a reinsurer, or that you're using a kind of reinsurance structure that then goes out or transforms the transaction out into the capital markets. Transformers are also often used because regulators understand reinsurance contracts. They don't necessarily understand capital market transactions or structures. The other thing to point out here is that these boxes aren't in isolation, so of course, if we do some kind of capital structural securitisation, it'll have ramifications for a whole multitude of those different options, whether it be in-force management through to accounting and tax optimisation, through to product design and pricing, etc. So they are interchangeable. Just want to spend a little bit of time going through a bit of the historical development. I mean, securitisation fundamentally is just pooling discrete risks and the income associated with those risks together, and then passing on that income and risk through to investors. Often it is about risk management, but more often it's about accessing market and accessing reasonable funding. Securitisation effectively started in the 1970s with mortgage-backed securities, but that was fairly closely followed by automobile loans as well as credit card receivables. The 1990s then saw securitisation for insurance entities. It was dominated predominantly by the non-life and cat bonds, but there was very early transactions done for life businesses. In particular, one of, I think, the first ones that was done by Hannover Re, which was an embedded value securitisation done in the mid-90s, and then there was non-life followed by AIG and USAA. The first cat bonds from a non-financial entity was in the late 1990s by the owner of Tokyo Disneyland. So obviously it was covering the major investment in the Disneyland facility. Cat bonds have gone through quite various transformations over the period, And what we are now seeing is that they're moving to a more standardised approach or structure. And that's important because as you move to a standardised structure, you've actually got a deeper investor market, and what you start to then have is a deeper primary market but also a deeper secondary market that goes through it. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the transformation of that market because I do think it's very much linked to investor appetite. And there is increasing investor appetite in the market globally for more bespoke transactions. And why? Because of the spreads that they're typically offering. The market is dominated by catastrophe bonds, but from a life perspective, we have seen cat mortality bonds, pandemic bonds coming through, embedded value or value in force securitisations, longevity bonds. I haven't seen DAC securitisation, but I suspect that's more because of the structures of the European and American life insurers, which have dominated the securitisation market for insurers. Now, I'm going to just look at the cat bond and ILS market. Why? Because that's a market that I can actually get some market stats on. This isn't representative of the total insurance market, but it does represent a fair proportion of it. What you can clearly see there is that from issuances, we saw a big increase coming through into the mid-2000s. The GFC hit, the market pretty much tanked for several years, but we're now starting to see new issuances starting to rise back to the kind of pre-GFC levels that we're seeing coming through. So now issues are coming through at about $9 to $10 billion. The 2015 figure you're seeing there is only for a quarter. The expectations is that 2015 will have a higher level of issuances to relative to 2014. What you can see, though, is the life market there represents a very small proportion of the overall issuances. It is dominated by the cat bond market. Total outstandings are roughly sitting at around $25 to $30 billion. When you put it into perspective of the overall bond market, which represents somewhere in the trillions of dollars, it really is a very small portion of the market. But I would say that this market doesn't actually have longevity bonds, which is quite a big market in the UK. It doesn't include the ILW market, so a lot of the investment banks will do like insurance loss warrants, so they'll give coverage over the total market losses. They won't give coverage to a specific insurer. And there's private placements. So I am aware of an Australian entity issuing insurance-linked notes in 2013 of about $120 million. I can't disclose their name, but they're not in these numbers, and it's not publicly listed. So there is a lot of private placements that do occur, and they aren't actually within these stats. Okay, I'm just going to take a back seat for a little section and go back to trigger points. And if you look at the cat bond market and the emergence of the cat bond market, it really started off by defining a trigger based on a parametric. And why? Well, because investors could understand a parametric measure. They were able to see that it's independent, they could actually look at its history, see the volatility, come up with a price. The problem is, from an insurer's perspective, it's quite remote and it's got significant basis risk to their underlying risk. Just because you have an earthquake of a Richter scale of 9.5, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to particularly lose any money, or you might lose significantly more or significantly less. What has happened in the evolution, though, is as investors have become more comfortable with this type of risk, you start to see that the trigger types have moved from parametric down to modelled loss index, down to industry loss index, down to indemnity. Now, indemnity for an insurer is the preferred option, because indemnity means if I lose $100 million, you pay $100 million. If I lose only $50 million, you pay $50 million. So what has been happening in this market is that investor appetite is increasing. So if I actually go back to the early 2000s and late 90s, basically, indemnity represented less than 20% of all issuances. The vast majority were going on indemnity or industry loss type structures. What we're now starting to see is, in more recent years, so from 2011 to 15, indemnity represented 53%. But if I actually look at transactions over the last 2 years, it's probably now closer to 70%. So investor appetite is definitely increasing within that market. The other thing we're also noticing is spreads. So that bottom graph is basically showing you expected losses on these particular notes through to coupons. And traditionally it's been running at around 4 times, but we've now started to see that pricing come into 2 times. So spreads are definitely coming in for this type of risk. The other thing that I'm not showing here is that appetite for duration is also extending out. So if we look at the insurance bonds or non-life bonds, they've typically been running at 3 to 5 years. During the GFC, they were down to 2 to 3 years. We're now starting to see appetite going out to 5 to 7 years. So definitely seeing all of the parameters indicating risk appetite is increasing. I do know for several of the private placements that have gone through for the region, they have been significantly oversubscribed. Here's some examples of monetising VIF, and here I am. Well, I am showing predominantly European structures, and I've got one end that is an American issuance. You can see there from the first three, for the Barclays, the Friends, and the Aegon structures, they were, well, the first two were public issuances, the last one was a private issuances. In effect here, they have securitised the surplus arising from a particular in-force book of business, and it's not, and it does cover a range of products. So you can put unit-linked business in there, you can put non-unit linked, participating, non-participating, etc. And you can see there that there is a whole range that's going through there. The other thing that you did see also pre-GFC is for public issuances, it typically had a guarantee or a credit enhancement from a third party, so like an AMBAC, etc. And that was to give investors greater credence, but following the GFC, the need or the value placed on the credit enhancement has reduced substantially. So a number of these structures are now going through without credit enhancement. The other thing is traditionally it's also been on a closed book, just keeps it a bit simpler. But what this does mean is that the profile runs off fairly quickly. So if you you think about the way typically life insurance is structured, you've got your payback of your DAC earlier on in the early years. So what's happening, you've got your lapses coming through. So typically your profile is going to be about 5 years. That doesn't mean the full term is 5 years. It means the majority of the cash flows are sitting within 5 years. Now, what Bank of Ireland did do in their transaction is to extend the term out and to provide greater flexibility. They actually included the option for the insurer to include new business for up to 5 years. So what that does is extends the actual capital support from the structure for, well, obviously out for an additional 5 years through for that product. The other thing, though, we have seen, and look, we haven't seen any major transactions since the GFC in regards to significant European issuances. More recently, we've started to see the reinsurers come back into the market. So RGA did an embedded value securitisation at the end of last year for $300 million US. What we have seen, though, is in Spain in particular, the bank assurers have been effectively selling off their in-force book of business. We've seen significant transactions. I'm only showing two here. I'm aware of at least 4 of them, and they're quite sizable. But they have all been private reinsurance structures. So if we just talk a bit about the bank assurance monetarisation, fundamentally the banks in Spain have been needing to raise capital. It's been very challenging to raise it on the banking side, but what they have been able to do is raise significant capital coming through for their life insurance business. So rather than sell the block of business and then sell their customer base, etc., they've basically reinsured 100% on a quota share basis. That obviously lets them obtain significant capital up front and continues for them to maintain that business. We just look at the reinsurance structures. Fundamentally, it's just a straight 100% quota share reinsurance structure that goes through. The difference, though, here is that the arrangement is around the surplus distribution, and often there will be significant discussions around the allowances for expenses. There will be allowances for potentially for investment income, etc., that might go through the structure. One of the things I would say, though, that on a cons perspective, there has been significant discount to embedded value. So in other words, it is a bit of a distressed market and the reinsurers are appropriately taking on that extra return. But the other thing that is also seeing is that these structures will often have a recapture requirement or a termination contract for the reinsurer. So in other words, if lapse rates do go beyond a certain point, the contract does terminate. Now, that type of condition in the Australian context would not get approval from APRA. So what is the benefits of going through from a reinsurance? Look, it's a single investor. It's generally relatively straightforward. Regulators are usually comfortable with reinsurance. They may not be comfortable with the level of upfront commissions being paid. And profit sharings can be used to ensure that the cedent and the life and the reinsurer have continued long-term skin in the game. I've already kind of gone through the cons in the sense of the haircuts that we're seeing to EV, risk appetite and capacity. In other words, you know, depending on how many players are going into this market, there will be certain constraints on capacity. I would, however, say from an Australian context, I actually believe that there is significant capacity and appetite from the reinsurers directly into this market or types of structure, and we've seen that more recently just from the MLC deal of $500 million quota share, although that was, I understand, a 21% quota share rather than 100% quota share of a particular book of business. So look, in considerations, just the surplus formula, how do you come up with the various factors that go into it? There might be collateral arrangements still required. So this is reinsurance. So if you are reinsuring a big block of business, there might be some considerations for a reinsurer to provide collateral. Obviously, the reinsurer is likely to retrocede some of this risk, and it wouldn't surprise me if the reinsurer actually then went to the capital markets and issued some bonds over this cover or a group of these covers. And negotiation can still take time. It's probably still going to take 9 to 12 months to go through this negotiation process. So how do we look at some of the private placements? The fundamental difference here is that often you'll have a vehicle in between the life company and investors, a special purpose vehicle here in this case, and the special purpose vehicle here isolates the cash flows. It also means that investors don't have access to all of the cash flows of the life company. They'll only have access to the cash flows or emergency surplus coming through from the various structures. It's often, though, the SPV is actually goes through a holding company, often rather than going through the life company, but you can put it directly through the life company as well. There is no reason why. It just depends on the structure. It also depends on how many life companies will be sitting in an entity. So one of the benefits of this is you can actually have books of businesses from different life company entities going up into this SPV, and then you can securitise several different entities. So obviously there is precedence for securitisation across the different product lines, so whether that be your unitise, etc. A publicly listing will typically give you access to a broad range of investors. It also means you can typically raise a larger amount of funds. Typically, you are going to get cheaper pricing on a public listing than you are on a private placement. And private placement here is not reinsurance. And I'll go through the private slide next. There is appetite from investors, and that investors do typically see this as asset diversification structures. Asset diversification for their overall portfolio. But more importantly, they do see it giving up liquidity for additional yield. Typically, on this type of market, you're typically seeing spreads. It does vary significantly by the structure, but you are seeing spreads of around 300 basis points. So what is the cons? Look, this can be quite complex structures. It can take a long time to put together. It is going to be more challenging from a regulator perspective. Often more complex reinsurance structures take them a while to go through. These structures are a lot more complex. And public placements will require significant investor education management. And what I mean by that is, whilst there is investor appetite for European and American risk, they won't be as familiar with Australian risk. So early initial issuances within this market will require significant investor education, again, depending on the structure and how much is lapse risk versus mortality risk versus morbidity risk, etc. Now, the reason I say depending on the level of risk is some of these structures are more akin to debt. And so what happens here is that you may only take, say, 50% of the VIF, but they might have access to 75% or 100% of the surplus arising, but their repayment schedule is as per a debt structure. So it's not that they get the extra funds, they actually have extra coverage to it. And if you do those types of structures, then you have less investor education required because they've got more comfort that they've got coverage. But it then goes down into a debt structure versus an equity structure, and so it does depend on the type of structure that you're looking at trying to issue. So private placement, look, I think, fundamentally this is just where you'll have an investor come straight through to an insurer. You may not have an SPV in this structure. You could just have simply an agreement or a reinsurance agreement. But often if you've got private insurers or investors, you'll have a kind of transformer reinsurance in place, and that's just, again, to make it into a reinsurance structure, and the reinsurer then issues out the notes to the investors. And it just allows an extra layer of protection between the insurer and the investor, but it also, again, as I said earlier, gives a greater comfort to your regulators that you've got a reinsurance structure and not a capital market structure. Look, again, it's very similar to the public placement. There is precedence for this. It can cover a range of different products. The reason going private versus public is it's often quicker. You can get it a bit more bespoke in the way you structure it and the products that you've got. And it typically won't have the same level of due diligence requirements and costs, etc., that goes for private placement. The downside, of course, on a private is you may not be able to access the same level of funds. So if you're looking at raising $1 billion, you're unlikely to be able to go private. But if you're looking at raising $100 million, then a private placement is probably the more likely route to go than a public type placement. Another option to look at here, and this really hasn't evolved in the market yet, is around, is there more flexible structures that could appeal to more investors? The simple answer is yes. Different investors have different appetites for various risks. So some investors are definitely looking at taking on lapse risks, some are taking on mortality or morbidity, etc. And so there is the option to structure the cash flows into the various components or drivers, and whether they be the investment, insurance demographics, policyholder behaviour being the lapsation. I would have to say, though, that typically this hasn't occurred in the market to date. And so going down this route would require substantially more time, education and structuring of the potential deal. However, one way to achieve this is fundamentally through DAC securitisation. DAC securitisation is different to a VIF in the sense that you are fundamentally only funding the upfront costs and you're paying for that by a percentage or share of the premium. Lapse risk typically won't come into it because you're going to have to over-collateralise the cash flows through that, and they're not taking a share of the surplus. So it's really a pure debt funding, and fundamentally it's going to be reliant on lapse risk. So what am I showing you in this structure? You've got a life company, SPV. The life company basically sells the DAC through to via the SPV that then issues the notes out to the capital markets. Now, fundamentally, what a DAC securitisation is saying, well, you've got an upfront kind of commission product. We're going to transform the cash flows that you so that you move to a level commission product. And fundamentally what happens is the difference between the initial commission and the level commission, you have the capital markets fund, and then the difference in premium that you normally would pay between the upfront commission and renewal versus the ongoing renewal then gets paid back through to the capital markets. In concept, investors might decide that they want additional funds than agents may or advisors, or they may decide that it's lower. The other point that you would need to note here is that that X times 8% of premiums, that X is actually the over-collateralisation factor. So investors will typically want to see some additional coverage. So, for example, if A was 15% of premium to pay for your DAC up front, investors might actually want 110% of that. That doesn't mean that you pay them 110%. You pay 110% into the SPV. The SPV pays out the 15%, not the 110% of it, but should the fund start to go into losses, because one of the conditions will be on this that you don't get repaid if there's actual capital adequacy or losses within the fund, depending on how you define it. But the SPV will have the additional surplus coming through it that they can then continue to meet the repayments until that is extinguished. Of course, you have 100% ownership of the SPV back, so if there is additional funds in that SPV at a period of time at the end, that would then go back through to the shareholders or the life company, depending on the structure that you have. So what are some of the key business considerations? Well, I mean, obviously, how much do you want? If you're saying from a capital perspective you'd like to fund $50 million, I think that's a very different consideration to if you're wanting to fund $500 million. Excuse me for a sec. So, for example, if you're doing $50 million, I mean, quite frankly, you wouldn't go, you'd probably just do straight reinsurance. Even private placements would probably be uncompetitive, unless you've already established a relationship with investors and they're willing to take additional funds for you. But given I'm not aware of any securitisation from Australian life companies, I suspect that's not going to be a viable option. Debt versus equity. So, look, a lot of the more recent deals have been structured with equity. In other words, there's upside and downside through to the investors. A lot of the earlier transactions were more debt structured. And what this is really talking about is, well, the investors took the downside, but they didn't take the upside. So, again, from a life company's perspective, what type of risk are you willing to share? And understanding if you're doing a debt structure, then it's going to probably form part of your debt issuance. Now, I should also stress that these structures don't have to be issued out of the life company. So, for example, if you've got a shareholder who owns the bank, you can actually have the shareholder issuing the notes secured over the cash flows or surplus emerging out of the life company so that the debt can actually sit on a different entity structure. Speed, so private placement, so how quickly do you want the funds? Obviously, if I had to rank them, I'd say reinsurance is probably the quickest. Then it goes to private placement, then public placement. Duration of the funding, how long do you need the funding for? Look, here it says typically 3 to 5 years, but that's talking about the runoff profile. Obviously, if you're secured against an in-force block of business, it's going to run off as the in-force block of business would have it. Some of them, though, do consider recapture conditions, and this is like saying once the book is run down to a very small proportion, there might be a option for the insurer to recapture that book because it's just costly to maintain an SPV, reporting, etc., and investors probably want their last 0.5% return back through to them. Flexibility, how bespoke do you want the structure versus how kind of plain vanilla do you want it? So private placements tend to be a little bit more flexible in the way that you can structure the deals. Complexity and costs, obviously, as you go to public placement, there's a lot more due diligence, a lot more costs that will be associated with it, and market conditions. So just where is the appetite, etc. Now, given it's a relatively small market, you will see the appetite quite volatile within this market until it starts to build. Questions?
So just a reminder, as with all the sessions, we're recording this, so please just jump up to grab the microphone and state your name before we have questions.
Eddie Fabrizio. Paul, on the DAC securitisation, one of the things APRA is also very interested in is about risk transfer. And obviously, lapse risk transfer, they don't consider to be risk. How do you solve the issue about getting proper risk transfer through a DAC securitisation, trying to get turning into a debt?
Well, the simple answer is I would see it as a debt structure rather than a reinsurance structure. So the risk transfer here would be the lapse risk. Now, I suspect APRA will be a bit difficult in any kind of DAC securitisation. And there is ways of getting around it, and you could be quite cute, but I suspect APRA would get a little bit antsy. And what I mean by that is there is a way of structuring it so that you actually put a structure in place between the life company and the advisor network that you're paying the commissions to. So fundamentally, you get agreement that you're going to transfer the commission payments from upfront to level, and that is going to be funded by the investors. And so from APRA's perspective, you just simply say, I've got a commission structure that I'm changing, and they've agreed to it, and it's just being funded by a third party. outside of the life company. Now, if you push the DAC structure as a pure debt structure, I think APRA is going to make you or make a life company included under their Tier 2 requirement of 20%. The other option is you get a bit cute and then you chuck in a bit of mortality risk and you pay big commissions up front on it. But fundamentally, I would argue that lapsation is a substantial risk within a life company, and to the extent that I'm managing that risk, I should get appropriate recognition for it. That doesn't mean logic holds in any other forum. But yes, I do think DAC securitisation will take some time to convince the regulators of its appropriateness. So yes, you might have to mask it as a VIF securitisation, but the so when you VIF securitise, I mean, the amount you pay up front and how much mortality risk you take on, I mean, can vary within certain bounds on it. But yes. And that's why I said you can do a DAC securitisation outside of the life company. So again, depending on your structure and how it then might be within that other structure. So interestingly enough, the Bank of Ireland deal, the actual issuance came out of the bank, not out of the life company. And it was done because of the way Solvency I at that time and the capital requirements for the bank, I shouldn't say Solvency I, Basel I or II, as it was being implemented in Ireland. It was an interesting deal also that in the Bank of Ireland deal, the surplus was only securing the spread on the bonds, not the actual overall return. Anyway, sorry, I'm diverging.
So do we have another question from the audience? There's plenty of food for thought here. Perhaps just while you're thinking of questions, Paul, is there any information on how past transactions have performed in terms of repayments and any issues?
On the life side, no. I mean, the transactions have been... I mean, obviously, some of the transactions that were done pre-GFC, investors have probably not got the same return profile, mainly because of the lapsation risk that's gone through. If I look at the bank assurance deals that have been done in Spain, I think investors are actually making a very good return on those profiles. But that was where the banks needed cash and they needed them fairly quickly, and so they've paid the price for it. It's gone through it. So, no, there hasn't been any major hiccups. There's obviously the return profiles come through, but we're seeing both the secondary market and private primary market yields come in, which means there is comfort for it. But I'll stress it's not a highly liquid market. So there is a number of funds that have been established to invest in across-the-board insurance-linked securities, obviously dominated by cat bonds, but they do have a significant appetite for life because they want the diversification across. So the whole point of these funds is that, I mean, cat bonds are usually binary. You either lose your 100 million or you keep your 100 million. And so they want to make sure they've got a whole diversification across geography, types of bonds, etc. So there is a significant appetite. So these funds are typically sitting at around $8 to $10 billion. And there's about seven that I'm aware of out there in the market. So private placement would typically go through, I suspect, one of these funds.
Paul, Mike Thornton from AMP. Given the growth in the cat bond market, it looks like the reinsurers have been sidelined. So is that creating new reinsurance capacity in other parts of the market?
Yeah, look, capital markets more broadly have probably now extended the non-life reinsurance capital by about 30%. I think cat bonds are representing now 20% plus of the overall cat market. Sidecars and other structures are also probably bringing in another 10 to 20%. So, yes, there is, not that I'm an expert in non-life reinsurance, but my understanding is there is significant capacity in the non-life market. And so potentially some of these DAC securitisations that haven't got a life component to it and not deemed to be insurance, life insurance, may be attractive to the non-life guys as well.
So, more questions?
I might just quickly talk a little bit about investors, and I don't want to kind of underestimate the work that is required to develop the market from investors. So, look, if you're going to put reasonable lapse risk in there and you're going to have substantial morbidity risk, and in particular DI risk, globally investors are not so comfortable with that kind of risk profile. What that does mean is that you will have to do a sizable roadshow to investors. It does mean that you'll have to do significant scenario testing and modelling of the portfolio to show them the kind of loss profile that could be sitting on the portfolio, and then ultimately coming back down to the level of collateralisation to give them comfort in it. So again, you can structure it so that they have access to a larger portion of surplus coming through from a particular book to provide them with additional coverage. But it will take a reasonable amount of work to get them to understand the risk profile. And I'd have to say that I think reinsurers in the current market have reasonable capacity, and so I suspect their pricing is going to be competitive relative to the capital markets.
So is there another question? Perhaps while you're thinking of that, just on that last point, Paul, talking of reinsurance capacity, would that be across the range of products that we have in the Australian market, or are reinsurers wanting to pick and choose a bit?
Well, look, I mean, if you theoretically had a unit-linked portfolio, I think it would be challenging to do a reinsurance structure around unit-linked, just because of the fundamentally, all you've got is your fee less your expenses coming through. So you can do it through a VIF securitisation. But other than that, no, I think reinsurers have... Well, obviously, I don't think that if you're trying to securitise group insurance, I don't think there's going to be huge appetite for that type of product. But I think from the risk perspective, YRT business, yeah. I mean, but like anything, depending on the risk profile of that business, the pricing is going to be different. As I said, the one benefit of the capital market structure is potentially you can over-collateralise it to bring your costs down, whereas reinsurance, you typically can't do that. I should also mention that I do think that in time, capital markets could actually be a good solution to the group insurance market. I mean, one of the issues with the group insurance market is, particularly at the large end, is that it can be very capital lumpy. In other words, you win a plan of $500 million premium, you need the capital to support it. And this can be both at the reinsurance level and at the insurance side. If you can develop the appropriate investor market, you could quite easily issue notes off and on, depending on whether you win plans or not, to actually help fund the capital requirements. The benefits of the group market will be it's a relatively short period of time, so investors will like that it's more going to be a 3 to 5 year term, and it's pretty much a definite term. As opposed to the VIF securitisation, which could drag out for 15 to 20 years for some of the smaller components. So I do think that there's an opportunity there on the group market, but having said that, I'm not sure that investors, given the volatility in the group market, will be keen to take on the mortality morbidity risk that's in that market at the moment. But if prices go up enough and the terms and conditions tighten up, there could well be an opportunity there. And it could well be an opportunity for the reinsurers as well, because they're going to have a lumpy capital requirement as well, but they can retrocede.
Hi, Paul. Luke Seabury from MetLife. I've got a question. Imagine if you were thinking of building a portfolio of life annuities. So you've got a bunch of retirees. These guys are going to hang around for 30 or 40 years. You don't know how long they're going to live. Also, you don't have any investments, any bonds, which go for that period of time. Can securitisation be a way to write this portfolio? Because I'm thinking these guys want to be paid back 5 to 7 years. No one's going to hang around for a 30 or 40-year investment. So could you write life annuities through securitisation?
So the simple answer is the longevity risk, yes, and there's a longevity market that does exist either through bonds and swaps and through reinsurers, but occurs predominantly in the UK market. So, yes, longevity risk will be. I don't think it will be much more challenging to take out the investment risk. I mean, obviously, you can use derivatives to extend out to, I'll say 30 years, but we know that after 10 years it's a bit illiquid, but there is the swap market will allow you to lock in rates up to 30 years. It just depends on cost. But so can you securitise the investment risk? I doubt it. I'd be surprised, although I'm sure an investment bank will take it on. They'll just swap it for you and charge you a bit extra. But the longevity risk, definitely there's a very sizable market for longevity risk, particularly dominating or emanating out of Europe.
So we've got time for one, maybe two more questions just before we get the bell. Do we have another question from the floor?
Well, even my presentation was just so comprehensive that I haven't left any point unturned, or pretty much everyone was asleep in the first minute and it's just woken up. I think it's the first rather than the latter. Well, do you want my prediction on the market?
Yeah, look, that would be...
fundamentally, I see this as a market that is in development. I don't think we're going to see any kind of issuances in the next couple of years. I do think reinsurers have plenty of capacity. I don't think... I mean, it's going to be a challenge to get APRA across some of the DAC securitisation issues. As I said, you could be quite cute and put a different kind of structure in place between the commission payments through to the advisors that could fund that difference. But I do think that if a company wanted to do a private placement, I think there is significant appetite for a couple of $100 million to go out there to market. But being the first mover in the country would have additional costs. So unless you can find a friendly investment bank who's willing to subsidise the upfront costs, but then again I think you're much more likely to not find one. So look, I don't think you're going to see a significant change in the market. I don't think you're going to see a lot of issuances in the next 2 to 3 years.
Well look, maybe just for me a final question. In terms of practicalities, I think Paul you said, and I don't know that I could see all the slides, but you said I think reinsurance may be slightly faster to get a transaction away rather than private or then public
yep.
placement. And I don't know whether this is relevant, but I mean, NAB came out and when they announced their intended transaction on the MLC portfolio, I think, you know, that announcement's just come out recently and they're saying they're hoping to get that away in Q4. So that's like 6 months or so. But what are some indicative timelines on, you know, the reinsurance and then also then right through the public placement?
Well, it's like anything. I mean, if you wanted to do a deal in probably 8 weeks, you could do it. You're just not going to pay the same as if you want to do it in a more... I mean, I would say you need 6 to 9 months. If you're doing anything sizable, so you're still going to need to talk to the regulators. You're still need to kind of negotiate. So depending on whether you're opening up to tender to a couple of reinsurers, you know, do they understand the portfolio, experience, et cetera, and then... obviously, the bespoke structuring. So how much do they want to give up front, and how much do they want to take back at the back end, and you know, and is there any kind of tricky terms that the reinsurers want? But from what I can see of the reinsurance structures that have been done in Australia, they're actually very cedent friendly. So there's no recapture provisions typically. There's no requirements for termination if lapse rates increase, etc. So that does make life a lot easier. But I'd still say you'll need 6 to 9 months timeline. I mean, public placement, I reckon you probably would need, you should bank on 9 to 12 months. Just depends. It already, I mean, if for example, you've already got investors that are very familiar with your risk profile, then yeah, it could be shorter. But to be honest, I doubt very many life companies have that kind of profile of investors.
So I think that's the warning bell. So there is time for another question if there was one. I don't see a hand. Any final questions? Okay, thanks, Anton.
Paul, Anton Capel from AMP. Just one question with the DAC securitisation structure. Would the new international accounting standards impact the ability to do that or the attractiveness of doing that, either sort of now in anticipation of those standards coming in or once the standards come in?
Well, fundamentally, the new IFRS standards will mean that from a P&L perspective, you can no longer effectively set up the DAC or basically amortise it over the life of the portfolio. So P&L aspects are going to become more poignant. So I suspect from a life company's perspective, either the change in IFRS, the current review of commissions, etc., on YRT or risk business, will lead to lower DACs potentially, or if it doesn't, then the need for something like this will be more important. But I think if I was to look at this from an IFRS perspective going forward, and given the regulatory issues, I would actually pay commissions through a third party and have them transform the asset cash flows. And it's that way you get around the regulatory issues of whether this is a risk transfer or not. So that would be my recommendation to go forward. It's just finding those appropriate investors. And maybe reinsurers might be want to be an investor in that company. But who knows if IFRS really will come in place at 2018. I've got more confidence that the Trowbridge recommendations are probably going to be adopted significantly earlier than IFRS requirements.
So perhaps we'll still be talking about proposed IFRS at the next summit in 2 years' time. So if there's no final questions, then it just remains for me to ask you to join me in thanking Paul for the presentation today. Thank you.